संप्राप्त परभागेन शुशुभाते अनुरंजितौ ततस्तावंगरागेण स्ववर्णेतर शोभिना संप्राप्त परभागेन शुशुभाते अनुरंजितौ ततः देन तौ दे ऑफ देयर बॉडीज रागेण विद द कलरिंग कॉस्मेटिक्स स्व देयर ओन वर्ण विद कलर्स exhibited para the highest bhagena excellence shushubhate they appeared beautiful anuranjitau anointed. Translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. Translation: anointed with these most excellent cosmetics, which adorned them with hues that contrasted with their complexions, the two lords appeared extremely beautiful.
Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjanishalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Vancha Kalpataru Vyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. Grateful to be here with all of you today. Seek the blessings of all the senior devotees so that we can speak on this exalted topic of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam and this holy dham of Vrindavan. So here, one of the most dramatic incidents from the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially in the life of Krishna, is being depicted. Is it there? So I will use this as a whiteboard to write some things or draw some things to illustrate. So generally, if we look at the life of someone, it's not that every day is a day of exactly the same level of interest. If say we decided to record everything that we did in a day for 24 hours, and the next day we are told, watch what you did for the 24 hours yesterday. Within 15 minutes we'll get bored. Isn't it? Now Krishna's life is such that every moment was fascinating. And yet, even among them, there are certain moments of transition which are especially fascinating. And if you consider the way that it's described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are 90 chapters. Out of them, the first 40 describe Krishna's Vraja Leela. And specifically, Vraja is Vrindavan Leela. And the next 10 will describe his Mathura Leela. So, right now, we are in that transition from Krishna, of Krishna coming from Vrindavan to Mathura. And after that, that last 40 chapters actually describe, in one sense, Krishna's Dwarka Leela. But it's not only Dwarka Leela. When Krishna is in Dwarka, most of the times he's not in Dwarka. He's traveling everywhere else. So among these three phases, it is while Krishna is in Vrindavan that he is mostly in Vrindavan. Now he has come from Vrindavan to Mathura. And from the perspective of that situation, if we consider, Vrindavan was like a small rural place. And Mathura, as compared, was, relatively speaking, an urban place. So if you consider a rough sports metaphor, suppose that right now the Wimbledon Tennis Championship is going on. But there is some unknown player who has played in some local small city sports clubs. And then that player comes for the first time on the international scene in a Grand Slam tournament. That is what we call as, say, in cricket we call it as the international debut. So we could say the Krishna's entry into Mathura is his like world debut. He's coming out from Vrindavan and he's coming out on the big scene. And when he emerges on the big scene, most players, they lose a few matches and after that they win some match. But there are some players who have a sensational debut. Right? Maybe their first match in the big leagues is with the world number one. And in the first match they defeat the world number one. It would be a huge sensation. So, it is something like that for Krishna. When he comes to Mathura, he does extraordinary things that captivate everyone's hearts. So, we will look at Krishna's actions in Mathura from three different perspectives. From the perspective simply of adventure, then from the perspective of diplomacy, and lastly from the perspective of devotion. Now, from the perspective of adventure itself, Krishna does amazing things. He will make this Lady Kubja transform an extraordinarily beautiful woman. Then he will just use one, you could say the original karate chop, and just a knockout blow. Of course, it's not just a knockout, it's knockout of the material world. So So then the sheer potential for adventure, the giant elephant that comes, and the elephant's sharpest part is its tusk, and Krishna just takes off the tusk and then wears that as a trophy and comes in. So the sheer drama, one after another, culminating in almost the effortless thrashing of Kamsa. It's almost like, if you see, I'll come to this thrashing of Kamsa towards the end, but in some ways, the way Krishna defeats Kamsa seems to be like an anticlimax. There are so many fearsome demons who come in so many ways, and at the end, the sender of all those demons, Kamsa, how does Krishna defeat him? Just smashes him with his fists. But we'll see how actually that's not an anticlimax, that's actually a climax. But that I'll come and talk about from a devotional perspective. But from the adventure perspective, Krishna is just bursting on to the big scene in simply amazing ways. He's performing miracles, miracles of love, miracles of power, miracles of heroism. And that just captivates everyone's hearts. Now, in one sense, for us who are reading the Bhagavatam from the first chapter of the 10th canto onwards, now we know, yeah, what's the big deal about Krishna performing miracles? Krishna has already done so many miraculous things, like lifting Govardhan Hill and overpowering so many demons. Bala Kridana Kam Iva. As Uddhava says, all these terrible demons came and he just killed them as if they were toys, effortlessly. So we say that it's normal for Krishna. Prabhupada in Krishna books often says, it is not at all wonderful. Now when it is wonderful, but Prabhupada says it is not wonderful, means it's not something which is fantastic. It is not something which is imaginary. It is not just a product of imagination. Now, Krishna Leela, it is fantastic, but it is not fantasy. Fantasy means it's a product of imagination. Fantastic means it's amazing. It captivates the imagination. It stuns us. So, Krishna has already done this so many times before. However, the time of Krishna Leela is not the time of social media. So it is not that one event happens and immediately there are always people with cell phones taking photographs and sending the photos immediately to other places. From the perspective of Mathura, what exactly happened in Vrindavan or what exactly was happening in Vrindavan was actually a mystery. From Kamsa's perspective and the followers of Kamsa and the other citizens of Mathura, all that happened was that demon after demon went, we could say, from Mathura to Vrindavan and Yadgatvana Nivartante. They went from Mathura to Vrindavan and they just didn't come back. What exactly happened over there? That the Mathura Kamsa knew something is fishy. Now, did Kamsa actually know for sure that this Krishna was the eighth son of Devaki? Well, sort of he suspected that. And if you go into the Acharya's commentary, there are different perspectives on this. But basically, he knew that how could all these demons be killed one by one? Surely something seriously fishy was going on. And it must be associated with what they say, the usual suspect here, Krishna. But that Krishna had killed the demons, that was not conclusively known. So, what exactly happened? And the way Yogamaya was there, even the Vrajavasis, they thought that actually, yeah, Krishna is miraculously protected and Krishna does wonderful things. But they thought it is the special blessing of Narayan. That because Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda have worshipped, so it is because of that. Of course, there is this tension between Aishwarya and Madhurya, that the Vrajavasis, when they are in danger, they do pray to Krishna for help. But after that, in normal time, they say, oh, you know, Krishna is just our lovable Vraja heartthrob. And they don't really think of him as God. So in that sense, for the Mathuravasis to see these miracles firsthand was something that was unprecedented. Now, of course, there was always interaction between the Vrajavasis and the Mathuravasis, but these were still two distinct places. And what the Vrajavasis always told, the Mathuravasis did not really always give full credence to that. But when something happened in Mathura, and there they saw one after another, so it was a stunning adventure. Like a dramatic entry of Krishna, as I said, in the big scene. Now if we, there are acharyas who have compared Krishna Leela and Ram Leela, and there are many fascinating parallels, and there are many fascinating differences. So in one sense, Krishna kept performing miracles right from his childhood itself. Now Lord Ram also did many miraculous activities, but generally his miraculous activities, his Bala Leela is not that much celebrated. There are some later enhancements, embellishments to the Ramayana, where some of his childhood miracles are talked about. For Lord Ram, his first big feat was when he left Ayodhya and went to the forest. That was when he protected Vishwamitra sacrifice from Subahu and Tataka. And because Lord Ram had not performed so many miracles before this, that is why Dashrath was horrified when Vishwamitra said, I want Ram to come and protect. He said, I'll give my whole army. Ram is just a child. He's not even fought a single war till now. How can he save? So his fighting and overpowering Subahu and Tataka, that was the first big thing that Lord Ram did. But in one sense, you could say for Lord Ram, it was in Ayodhya, and from Ayodhya, he went to the forest. And that's where his big miraculous action happened. For Krishna, in Vrindavan, he was performing many amazing things, but when he came to Mathura, that was where he performed something stupendous. Now, specifically the title of this pastime that is there, title of this particular chapter that is there, the breaking of the sacrificial bow. There's a breaking of the bow in Ram Leela and there is a breaking of the bow in Krishna Leela. Now, in Ram Leela, the breaking of the bow will happen a little later when he wins the hand of Sita. Now, here it is, the breaking of the sacrificial bow will happen actually even before the big event. The big event is Krishna's encounter with Kamsa. So in one sense, the breaking of the big bow was a very big event in Ramayana, but in Krishna Leela, it's just like one of the events. It's like sometimes before a big match, before a big test match, there are warm-up matches. So the big match is Krishna's confrontation with Kamsa. And breaking the sacrificial bow is like a part of the warm-up. But that itself is extraordinary, what is going to happen. So from the perspective of adventure, what Krishna has done is extraordinary. But along with that, see, while Krishna at one level is just a 10-year-old boy, and in one sense, he just has that same innocent, fun-loving mood that characterizes his pastimes in Vrindavan. So he sees something attractive. He says, okay, I want these clothes. I want these garlands. And he sees this beautiful woman, and she wants to offer some service. He sees something from her and he wants that. So there's almost like a childish innocence to Krishna's activities here. He is at one level still just a child. Just a 10-year-old boy. For the first time he has come to a big city. Now, in Vrindavan, when they have heard about the city, they have heard about Mathura, but they've never been there. And Nanda Maharaj would go, but Krishna was just a small child. And in general, Nanda Maharaj used to think that it seems that even in our small and safe village, so many dangers befall Krishna. If we take him to the city, what will happen? So therefore, although Krishna requested, when Nanda Maharaj would go every year to give taxes to King Kamsa, And as Krishna grew older, he would notice, where is my father going? He said, I want to come with you. Krishna comes about, Nanda Maharaj would say no. But in this particular case, it was Kamsa who had sent that invitation. Now, when a king sends an invitation, it's not an invitation, it's an instruction. So, Nanda Maharaj could not refuse it. And he had to go and he had to take Krishna with him. And on top of that, it's one thing to send an invitation. It's like, suppose there's a wedding ceremony and we send a, if there's a wedding ceremony in our family, we send a greeting card or something, wedding card, invitation card. It's one thing. But suppose somebody sends not just a wedding invitation, but they send a car with a chauffeur, please come for the wedding. Now, if you say no, it's not just a refusal to the invitation, it's like a dishonor of the inviter. So, when the chariot was sent, at one level, it seemed to be like a great honor offered to Krishna. But at the same time, you know, the greater the honor is offered, the greater is the dishonor when that honor is refused. Isn't it? So, there is no way Nanda Maharaj could have said no at this particular time. And Krishna in his own childlike way was just enjoying, yeah, I want to go. And in fact, if you see the way the events happen, Akrura actually talks with Krishna first. Normally if you say, if a child is to be invited, sometimes there are some small children who are prodigious talents. And maybe some sports coach has spotted them. Some sports scout has spotted, oh, this is such a good cricketer, this is a sports player. And I want to come to try out for the nationals. They will normally talk with the parents. But in this case, when Akrura comes, he talks with Krishna and Balram. And Krishna and Balram have to persuade Nanda Maharaj. Krishna does that actually. But the point is, there is no way Nanda Maharaj could refuse. So, from the perspective of diplomacy, there was a lot going on over there. Now, we see earlier, Vasudev tells Nanda Maharaj that, you please go back to Vrindavan, because there might be danger. That is the time when he goes back and he finds that Putana has been killed. So, Nanda Maharaj, he's a little concerned, what's going on? Why is Krishna being invited like this? So, there is some concern, but there is no, like, overpowering fear. The fear is more of separation from Krishna. Even when the gopis, they are heartbroken while Krishna is going. It's interesting, the gopis' pain is that Krishna is going away from us. Their fear is not for the safety of Krishna. Because while from the Vrajavasi's perspective, there were many demons who were coming one after another after another. But it was never explicitly clear that all those demons were sent by Kamsa. It's not that it was not clear. It is not that they didn't know, but it is not explicitly clear. Kamsa also had, to some extent, his arrogance. So, his arrogance was such that, see, there were two sides in Kamsa. One was his fear, and the other was his pride. His fear was that the eighth child of Devaki will kill me. And therefore, he didn't want to take any chances. And that's why he decided to kill all the children of Devaki. But on the other side, there was his pride. And his pride was that I am so powerful that nobody can kill me. And that is the reason that is explained that why Kamsa actually allowed Vasudev and Devaki to have children. If the child was a threat, then he could just have not allowed them to unite. He could have kept them separate and there would have been no children. Now what he wanted to do was, see, he didn't just want safety. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that for those who have been honored, dishonor is worse than death. Sambhavita sa chakirtir maranaditir ichyate. In 134 he says. So for him, he had got the prestige, the reputation, that he had defeated even the Devatas. And while one side of him was fearful, oh, this Akashvani has come, the celestial voice has prophesied that I will be killed by the eighth child. But what he wanted to do was that if I can prove that prophecy to be wrong, then the whatever little respect people have for the celestial powers, that will be completely destroyed. And then my claim to power will be totally unrivaled. And thus, he let the child be born. And his idea was, I will prove the prophecy to be wrong. The child will kill me, let the child be born, I will kill the child. And so in that, with that arrogance, he let the children be born. Now when the eighth child turned out to be a woman, a girl, a female child, he was taken aback. And it was not just a female child, it turned out to be the goddess. And he himself was a worshipper of the goddess. So he started thinking, see, generally, whenever something does not go the way we think it would, we all have a worldview. And when the evidence does not fit our worldview, then what we try to do is, we try to distort the evidence so that it somehow fits the worldview. So when the eighth child turned out to be not Vishnu but the goddess, now he thought that Vishnu is my enemy, but the goddess is one whom I worship. And if she is born from Devaki, then Devaki must be a special lady. And then he thought, he apologized to Devaki and Vasudeva profusely. But he also said that, no, you should not blame me. It is indeed a sign of Kali Yuga that even the celestial voices lie. They misled me. Because they misled me, therefore I had to do this thing. And please understand that actually everything happens by the will of destiny. So it's like he apologized. But there is a phenomena called apology, non-apology. That means the apology that you offer with one hand, you take away with the other hand. Like you say, I'm sorry if my words hurt you. I'm not sorry for the words I spoke. Actually, if you feel hurt, that means you are a super sensitive snowflake. But still you got hurt, I'm sorry. So the apology you are giving with one hand, you are taking with the other hand. So he said, and one side he says, I'm sorry that I killed your children, but actually it was not me, it was destiny. So this kind of action is typically, you know, it is to rationalize. Now when we rationalize, what do? We tell rational lies. Rationalize, you know. No, if a man is smoking and his wife comes, he says, you told me you'll stop smoking, why are you smoking? Actually, the room was very cold, I wanted to make it warm for you. So, it is basically, rationalize means to give a more acceptable reason for a less acceptable action. So that's what he did at that time. So even now, he wanted to maintain that facade. And I am a good person. See, there are very few bad people who like to be portrayed as bad people. Krishna also talks about, even the cold-blooded demons, Krishna talks about in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Asau maya hatah shatru hanishye chaparanapi. This enemy I have killed and that enemy I will kill after that. But those people also, what Krishna says, yakshe dasyami modishya. I will do yajnas. I will give charity. In this way, I will be glorified as a good person. So even people who are very bad, they may enjoy their reputation of being bad in the sense that it creates fear and it creates obedience, absolute obedience to their authority among their subordinates. But nobody likes to be seen fully as a bad person. That's why they like to do some good things, by which they will have also a reputation that it's not such a bad person. after Duryodhan had tried to disrobe Draupadi, it was Dushyasan who did, but it was under Duryodhan. So, and the Pandavas were defrauded of their kingdom. It was extremely bad optics. Because what he had done was a naked power grab. And what did Duryodhana do? He decided that I will perform a big yajna, in which I will call the Brahmanas, I will give charity to the Brahmanas, I will give charity to the citizens. And he performed a yajna, which ironically was the Vaishnav yajna. He was torturing the devotees of Vishnu. He had no faith in Vishnu as such, no special faith in Vishnu. But he did the Vaishnav yajna. Why? Yakshe dasyami modishya. So because he wanted to maintain that reputation, I am a good person. So similarly, here, Kamsa, he, although he was a tyrant, but he wanted to maintain the reputation that he is a good person. So, in general, even tyrannical people in the Vedic times, generally speaking, they might attack and even assassinate or poison other rivals of theirs. That means among the Kshatriya families, all kinds of terrible things, intrigues might happen. But civilians were generally not targeted. Civilians, although it was not a democracy, but it was not just brute autocracy, where the citizens were crushed into compliance. They tried to win the citizens over. So, Kamsa had also, he was also doing his own yajna, and in Mathura also there were people who were his supporters. So now when Krishna is coming, Krishna actually, before his main confrontation with Kamsa, he travels around Mathura. From the perspective of a child, he's simply having fun exploring the city. But he's doing something more. He's winning the hearts of the Mathuravasis. Many of them, see, people in general are not monolithic. Not everybody is having the same ideas or same beliefs. So what happened in Mathura, some of the Vrajavasis would tell, and some of the Mathuravasis already were in love with Krishna. Some of them were a little bit like fence sitters. Some of them didn't really know what is going on over here. Some of them were totally partisans of Kamsa. But Krishna, by going around, what happened was that he simply won the hearts of the Mathuravasis. In fact, there is an elaborate analysis which you could note separately, how Krishna actually, in one sense, gives glimpses of all the rasas. There are people who admire him, that's in Shantaras. There are people who offer him service, that's the Dasyaras. There are, where he meets Uddhava, and there are others who earn Sakyaras for him. I won't go into elaborately. Then of course, Nanda Maharaj, Vasudeva and Devaki, that's the Vatsalyaras. And then it's described that the ladies of Mathura also are attracted to Krishna. This is mentioned briefly in the Bhagavatam, in Gopal Champu it is elaborated much more. So Krishna, in one sense, cast this a similar spell on the Mathuravasis that he has cast on the Vrajavasis. Krishna's charm wins their hearts. And that is why eventually, by the time the wrestling match starts happening, at that time, when Krishna and Balaram have to fight against Chanur and Mushtik. So, at that time, it is such that all the Mathuravasis, almost all of the people who are assembled over there to watch this wrestling match exhibition, it is supposed to be just like a sporting encounter for entertainment. These wrestlers are supposed to fight among each other and people will cheer. But when Krishna and Balaram are asked to wrestle, the citizens protest. They say, this is unfair, this is unfair. And Kamsa just cannot bear it. What insolence! He says, how dare they accuse me and my arrangements to be unfair. That's why Charu and Mushtik try to do some reasoning to show, it's not unfair. Now you have wrestled. you wrestle with each other, you cowherd boys, you wrestle with each other. So let's have wrestling over here also. And we've heard that, you know, you have killed demons also, so let's see if you can kill us. Something like that. They try to again give some reasoning. And eventually, when Krishna actually defeats all the wrestlers, Krishna and Balaram do it together, that is the time when all the citizens start openly glorifying Krishna and reproaching Kamsa. So even initially they are protesting, but it's a little restrained because they are not really sure how powerful Krishna is. Now, if they go against Kamsa and then Kamsa hits back at them, that would be deadly for them. But when they see Krishna and Balaram are so powerful, they all start cheering Krishna and they start reproaching, they start condemning Kamsa. And this is something which Kamsa just can't bear. Again, for one who has been honored, dishonor is worse than death. He is the king, this is his celebration, and some upstart has come over here and he is being celebrated, and Kamsa the king is being condemned. And that's why what Kamsa speaks at that time is completely depraved. He says, arrest Nanda and the coward boy. He says, plunder their wealth. Kill those who have protested, those who have raised their voice against me. Go to Vrindavan and plunder the wealth. He speaks a big rant. A brief part of that rant is given in the Bhagavatam. In the Acharya's writings, it has been elaborated further. Now, what is Krishna doing by this? Krishna is actually exposing Kamsa's true character to the whole world. That Kamsa's colors, true colors come out over here. So in one sense, before Krishna wins the battle with Kamsa, Krishna wins the battle of optics, the battle of reputation, the battle of perceptions. See, in diplomacy, perceptions matter a lot. Now, what is right is important, but who appears to be right is also important. Justice needs to be done, but justice also needs to be seen to be done. And Krishna's strategic intelligence, which will be seen at its best in the Kurukshetra war, that is seen right over here. So although Krishna is a small child, but Krishna is winning the hearts of those whom his dynasty is going to rule in the future. Krishna, eventually, when Kamsa is going to be killed, what happens is, by that time, Kamsa has already lost all supporters. This winning of the war of optics, the how things appear, we could call it today like the PR battle, the public relations battle. Krishna is expert at winning that. When Krishna goes as the peace messenger to Kurukshetra, at that time, Vidura says the previous night, Krishna is staying at Vidura's house. Krishna, why have you come here? You know Duryodhan is not going to listen to you. And I have even heard rumor that Duryodhan may arrest you. He says, I have already seen one unbearable dishonor in that assembly. And to this day, I regret that I was not able to stop that dishonor. Whose dishonor was that? Draupadi's. He says, I will not be able to live with myself if I have to see you dishonored over there. So Krishna says, oh, Vidura, I know that Duryodhan is not going to settle for peace. But I want the world to know that this war was not caused by the Pandavas. This war was caused by Duryodhan. And while externally it was Krishna's peace mission, internally it was Krishna's PR mission on the behalf of the Pandavas. And actually when Duryodhan rejects the peace proposal, he says, I will not give enough land to put even the tip of a needle through. Now, if that had been the time of social media, it could have become a viral Insta reel. Kya dialogue hai? What a dialogue. But while Duryodhan may have applauded himself for coming up with such a dialogue, but he didn't, Duryodhan didn't realize that he was actually fully playing into Krishna's hands. Because what does it mean? What it means to, let's come understand the context. Suppose we invite somebody for a program at our place. And they don't want to come for the program. So they make some excuse. Now they are making an excuse. We know that they are making an excuse. And they know that we know that they are making an excuse. But at least out of politeness, they are trying to make an excuse. But if they say, that even if I die, my dead body will never come to your program. Now that is not just a refusal of the invitation, that is a kick in the face of the inviter. So, when Krishna goes as the peace messenger, that is like, say, now right now the war between Russia and Ukraine is going on, and say one of the head of states, either Ukraine's head of state or Russia's head of state, goes to the other country personally to seek peace. And that peace proposal is publicly rejected. And on top of that, say, that country's head of state is attempted to be arrested by the other country. Then it will become clear for everyone that it is this country which rejected the peace proposal that is the cause of the war. So Krishna as a strategist won the PR battle. Whatever Duryodhan had got, because what had happened, the Pandavas were in the forest and they were cut off from the world, and Duryodhan was the king, and Duryodhan used all his royal resources to try to spin the story in a different way. He tried to make himself not seem like the bad guy. And it was his spin doctoring in one sense was so good that even Balram was won over. But the point is, Krishna completely won that PR battle. And similarly, that is what Krishna is doing right now, even as a child. And that brings me to the last part. I talk from the devotional perspective. Now from the devotional perspective, we see it's all simply a leela. And Krishna is simply reciprocating love with his devotees. And all the demons that are there, they are just incidental to the primary reciprocation of love between Krishna and his devotees. Like in Govardhan Leela, Indra and his causing of rains is just in the backdrop. You know, initially he's there, but after that for 7 days, he's just completely neglected. And that is far more humiliating. You know, if somebody attacks, a powerful person attacks and you defeat that person, that itself is humiliating. But somebody is attacking and you don't even pay attention to the attack. So, that's completely humiliating for them. Krishna eventually kills Kamsa, it's almost effortless. Kamsa has taken out his sword and he's about waving his sword. But Krishna jumps up from the wrestling arena, he stays hugely, jumps up onto the high stage where Kamsa is sitting and just catches him and hurls his throne away and just beats him and then hurls him on the ground, pounds him to his death and drags him away. So it's a remarkably effortless victory in one sense. Now, the point over here is that it might seem like an anticlimax, but Krishna is not really concerned with Kamsa. Krishna is concerned with his devotees. Krishna is concerned with Vasudeva and Devaki. And he wants to assure to them by demonstrating that they have absolutely no danger. That this tyrant Kamsa, whom even the gods could not defeat, Krishna just so effortlessly defeated them. So in that effortless victory is an extremely reassuring demonstration of Krishna's extraordinary prowess. And on one side, he is winning the hearts of the citizens by his beauty, by his adventure, by his charm. But the Yadus and all the associate dynasties, the Vrishnis, Andhakas and Bhojas and all of these dynasties who have either submitted themselves to Kamsa or who have fled away in fear. Krishna wants all of them to come back and be united. And by his effortlessly crushing Kamsa, what Krishna is doing is, he is demonstrating to his devotees that he is here for them. And thus, we'll see there's a remarkable consolidation that happens in Mathura after Kamsa is killed. All those who have gone far away, they come back. And thus Krishna's pastimes move forward. So all that is a prelude to this in this particular section, where Krishna is beautifully endearing himself to everyone in Mathura and carrying forward his mission. Prabhupada says that his mission is, as we know, paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya dushkritam. But Prabhupada says paritranaya sadhunam is not just to deliver the pious people. It is to deliver the devotees who are suffering in separation from Krishna. And this is for Vasudeva and Devaki, a long awaited reunion. That child for whom they had waited for so long, and finally when they got that child, they just had him for a few minutes. Just one conversation with him, and they had to let him go. And now they are seeing him after 10 years. So their hearts are completely solaced and won over by Krishna's victory. And after that, Krishna's very humble and sweet and endearing reunion with them, that will be subsequently described. So I'll summarize. I spoke about Krishna's entry into Mathura, which is a broader part of this pastime, from three perspectives. First was from the perspective of drama or adventure. How Krishna, as a small child, is entering into Vrindavan, and from Vrindavan to Mathura, and is just performing spectacular activities that win the hearts of the Mathuravasis. Then I talk from the perspective of diplomacy. How Krishna, the way he acts, is also meant to win over the citizens. Not just attract their hearts, but to win them over. He's winning the PR battle. Because Kamsa, although evil, didn't act as if he was evil overtly. He tried to act as if he was good, and his tyranny was exposed by Krishna's actions when he said, just destroy everyone. And then when Krishna effortlessly destroys him, that devotional glory, how he's ultimately actually reassuring the hearts of his devotees, and thereby all this dramatic and diplomatic action is like a sideshow. For Krishna, what is primarily happening is the sweet reciprocation of love between him and his devotees. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. We have time for one question. Is there any? Yes, please, Ro.
Hare Krishna, Ro. Thanks for the nice class. So the question is, when can a devotee seek honor instead of humility? Because sometimes humbleness is also considered as a weakness for a devotee. So when should a devotee seek honor and
okay, come good back question. So when should the devotee seek honor? Can humility be an obstacle? Well, my understanding, let's start with Srila Prabhupada's example. At one level, Srila Prabhupada was so humble when he was asked, when he was talking about the four varanas. Somebody asked Prabhupada, in America he was talking about four. So which varana do you belong to? Prabhupada didn't say the Brahman, he said, I am the servant of all the Varanas. So many times Prabhupada exhibited extraordinary humility. But when Srila Prabhupada had come to India, or he started focusing on India, some of his female disciples had gone to Jaipur to get some deities made. And at that time, these Vaishnavis were doing, while they were waiting for the deities to get made, they would go to the Jaipur temple, Radha Gonji temple, and do kirtans. And the people there were amazed, they were charmed. And they asked, what can we do? You know, who are you? Where have you come from? And they said, we are Swami Prabhupada's disciples. And they said, what can we do for you? He says, invite our guru for program over here. They said, yeah, we'll do that. And they organized a big program for Prabhupada. So Prabhupada was very pleased and proud that even his female disciples, they had not even gone for preaching, they had just gone there for getting some deities, and they had organized a big program for him. Now, when they came to meet Prabhupada and told some of the details, Prabhupada saw the pamphlet that was made. And it says, Swami Prabhupada and his foreign disciples. So Prabhupada said, why foreign disciples? You should write American and British disciples. Now, Prabhupada actually had the pamphlets reprinted at that time. He said, now he says, was Prabhupada, you could say, honor hungry in that sense? No, not exactly. Prabhupada had a mission. His mission was that Indians were enamored by the West. So those whom you are enamored by, they are actually attracted to bhakti. That's what Prabhupada wanted to show. So, for that purpose, you could say Prabhupada almost sought honor. Isn't it? So the way I understand is, humility means to not let our ego come in the way of our purpose. We all have a purpose. Our purpose is to serve Krishna. And if for the service of Krishna, a certain level of honor is required, then seeking that honor is not against the principle of humility. It's ego can come in too many ways. Ego can come in many ways. Like some people may be, how should I put it? Some people have such a big ego that if they are not respected, they'll just make a big, they'll just throw a tantrum because of it. If you see from an external perspective, when Srila Prabhupada was in India, he was reasonably respected. Here in Vrindavan, he was respected as sadhu. Even in India, whether he went to Mumbai or to Delhi, he was respected as sadhu. He was not attracting dedicated followers. But he was a respected as sadhu. Wherever he would give him some food to stay, people would come and hear katha from him. And from India, when Prabhupada went to America, at that time, nobody knew him at all. So nobody cared for him. Prabhupada was just walking along on the streets all alone. And eventually, even when he got some students, they had no idea of etiquettes. So when they used to use the restroom, Prabhupada had to stand in the queue to use the restroom in the house where he was staying. So from an external point of view, when Prabhupada went from India to America, you could say he had greater respect in India. In America, at least in the initial years, he had far lesser respect. But Prabhupada had a purpose. So if our purpose requires that we sometimes suffer dishonor, we should be ready to suffer that. But if our purpose is better served by honor, then we don't demand that honor. Ideally, that honor is to be commanded. But if somebody is not honored at a particular place, and that lack of honor is preventing us from doing some service, then we may have to decide that maybe this is not the best place for me to do the service. If a preacher travels to a particular place, and nobody seems really interested in hearing from that preacher over there, then the preacher will think that, let me go somewhere else. If a devotee has some talent, it managerial talent, musical talent, whatever talent they have, and they can use that in Krishna's service, but if they're not given the facilities, one facility is of course honor. Honor doesn't mean that people have to come and offer respect, obeisances and do vyas puja. Honor could just mean that, you know, whatever facility is required for that service, that facility needs to be given. If that is not given, the devotee may decide that I'll go somewhere else and do the service. So a devotee is not honor conscious. A devotee is service conscious. And we don't let our ego come in the way of our service either way. That sometimes I may get too much honor and that may come in the way of my service. Sometimes we may get too little honor and that may come in the way of our service. In the West, especially in America now, there's a lot of race consciousness, you know, the racial discrimination and stuff like that. So in general, when devotees go at the, if some devotees come at the airport, the general advice is, don't offer obeisances in public. Because what happens is, there is a history of slavery there, and slaves were expected to bow down to their masters. So people get that kind of image. So sometimes even the gurus and sannyasis and senior devotees say, don't offer obeisances in public. So the idea is that there getting that honor can create an unfavorable perception. So devotees, honor is not as important for a devotee as service. So, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Granthraj, Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Itai Gaur Premanande.
Krishna Hare Krishna Krishna Hare Hare Hare